I'm joined on the phone by Dick J. Revis. He is the author of If White Kids Die, Memories of a Civil Rights Movement Volunteer, The Ashes of Waco, An Investigation, formerly a reporter of the Dallas Observer, former senior editor of Texas Monthly, and currently a reporter for the San Antonio Express News. Welcome, Mr. Revis.
Glad to be here.
I guess I should ask you first, why did you write this book, The Ashes of Waco?
When all of that happened, the 51-day siege and so on, I kept thinking, when are we going to hear the other side of this story? Meaning the story from the side of the Davidians or the followers of David Koresh. Then the building burned down and we didn't hear anything more. And when the building burned down, a lot of people got out of jail, and the search warrant, which had been sealed during the 51 days, was made public. But the newspapers didn't write about any of that because they'd already gone home. And I thought, wait a minute, we still need to get the other side of this story. So I started poking around, and pretty quick I saw it would take a book to handle the subject.
And it was the only one for quite a while, too, wasn't it?
There was one, I think, that came out, I mean, it depends on what you call a book. But there was a quickie made from newspaper clips by a guy from the National Enquirer, or one of those Florida papers. And there was not a bad book put out by a fellow here in Waco, so there were a couple of minor books before mine.
But yours is the one that kind of really made the splash and got all the national attention, right?
Yeah, I think mine has become the definitive book, or the primer, meaning all the Waco buffs have read mine, and then a lot of them have read other books.
Right. Yeah, I would suggest for anybody who is foolish enough to think they want to know everything about this story, I would recommend yours and The Davidian Massacre by Carol Moore. I think the two of those go together real well. Who were the Branch Davidians? Let's get to this other side of the story thing here. Who were these people?
It's a long story about who they were, but who they first are is a radical splinter off the Seventh-day Adventist Church. All Davidians call themselves, at least all of them I know of, Davidian Seventh-day Adventists. And the group that was here in Waco was founded in 1934 by Mr. Huff, a man who's long dead. They divided into Plain Davidians, Davidians of the Adventists, and Branch Davidians. And then on comes David Koresh. The David takes over, and the Branch splits. So the Branch Davidians was actually that existed before David Koresh. David Koresh's group had no name, and Branch Davidians what the press wound up calling David's followers.
So they didn't really identify themselves as a group like that. They didn't have a title for themselves.
No, they called themselves Students of the Seven Seals, or Students of the Bible. They didn't really have a name. Still don't.
Well, the government and the media, even to this day, if you include the special that ran on NBC the other night, they have demonized David Koresh and this whole group as a bunch of dangerous fanatics. Are these portrayals valid?
I don't think the word dangerous is fair, because they didn't pose a danger to anybody outside of Mount Carmel. And if they posed a danger to anybody inside Mount Carmel, it would have been on the ground of statutory rape. Meaning that David did sleep with some women who were younger than the age of consent. But the idea that they were going to come to Waco and shoot up a Luby's cafeteria or something, all of that was fiction.
Now, remember, the news really, they really did try to make us believe that the reason that they had all these guns was because they were preparing to attack the rest of us, right?
Well, such things were said, but there was just no basis for that. They had those guns. One is a business, and two, because their reading of the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation said that someday the soldiers of Babylon would attack them, would attack God's faithful, and that they should defend themselves.
And so it was sort of the guns plus that teaching that kind of brought them to the ATF's attention then, I guess, huh?
I think they had guns, they had strange religion, and they had strange sexual customs. The three things that the American Indians had, and look what happened to them.
Huh.
And the American Indians got wiped out and burned out, just like David Koresh and his people.
Can you tell us a little bit about Paul Fatta? I remember reading something about one of the Davidians, that he had left that morning with most of the guns. Is that correct?
Now, Paul Fatta, who is still alive and is in jail, is in federal prison. Paul Fatta was the money man at Mount Carmel, meaning he had an income that many other people didn't have, and he helped finance everything that went on at Mount Carmel. And he was in charge of Mount Carmel's gun show business. He took guns and ammunition vests and hollowed out grenades that were used as paperweights. He took those things to gun shows every weekend and sold them, usually with two or three other people. And on the morning of February 28th, when the ATF attacked Mount Carmel, Paul and his son were out at a gun show. And they tried to get back when they heard what happened, and Paul winds up getting taken into custody.
On what charge?
Well,
I mean, he wasn't even there, right?
No, he wasn't there. Who knows what the charge was at the time? But he's now in prison for gun violations, as all of them are. They're all in prison for having used a gun in the commission of a crime.
Yeah, well, let's get to the trial toward the end here.
Mm-hmm.
We got a lot to cover. Mr. Revis, help me understand why the ATF chose, why they chose to arrest David Koresh in the way that they did. Why did they choose the assault on the house instead of, like the cliche goes, waiting for him to go to Walmart and arresting him on the street?
I don't think we know. What we suspect is that they filmed this effort, and they had a budget hearing coming up, and the ATF was in trouble because both female and non-white agents had filed discrimination suits. And so here you had a federal agency that females and blacks were claiming discriminated against them. You had a Democratic Congress. The ATF had a budget hearing coming up, and our theory, or a theory of a lot of people, is the ATF wanted to take film of this raid on what could have passed, or they would have announced as armed white Christians, want to take this film to a Democratic Congress and get some more money for raiding those Christian fanatics, or those white Christian fanatics. And what the ATF says is that they wanted to catch Koresh and the guns in the same place.
Well, but they wouldn't need to do that, would they? I mean, legally, if they had arrested him on the street and then served a warrant to search the house...
No, they wouldn't have needed to do that.
So
for that matter, they probably could have arrested him there. At least the county sheriff, Jack Harwell, says he could have gone out and done everything right there.
As in, he could have just walked
David
up to the door. He could have just walked up and knocked on the door.
Right. He had been there many times. His deputies used to go fishing there.
Well, and Koresh had invited the ATF to come out and inspect his weapons, right?
He had invited them in, and they had turned him down.
They didn't want to come in unless they had their guns drawn. Is that it?
They have never given a good explanation of why they didn't go when he invited them. All that I know they've said is that we didn't want to do it that way. I can't imagine why they didn't.
Well, which leaves us back at the publicity stunt thing, which is just unforgivable. The idea of people's lives being lost so that they'll look good on TV or look good in front of the Congress in a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm. Now, it has to be said here, the ATF did not believe anybody was going to resist them. They thought that this would go down like the raids they pull every day on dope dealers. You know, they encircle the dope dealer's house. Dope dealer looks out and sees the ATF all around him, picks up his telephone, calls his lawyer, and then surrenders. That's what they thought was going to happen. They didn't understand that the people inside Mount Carmel don't think like dope dealers.
Well, that was one of the allegations against them, wasn't it, that they had a drug lab?
That was one of the allegations against them, but I think even the ATF knew that that was nonsense. what happened was that they flew over with a heat-sensitive camera, and it showed a hot spot right there in the kitchen.
In the kitchen, a hot spot?
Yeah. And the ATF says, we think they're cooking up meth in that kitchen.
And this,
sure.
This was used as their excuse to borrow Texas National Guard helicopters to fly
that's right.
That day, right?
As a
loophole in the posse comitatus law.
Right. But I don't think the ATF ever believed that itself.
You mentioned about the warrant was sealed throughout the siege and wasn't unsealed until after it was over. I guess there's no usual frame of reference to compare to, but, I mean, do warrants usually stay sealed until the arrest is complete or that kind of thing?
They usually do, but usually that's a matter of 3 hours.
Right.
This 51-day situation is kind of unprecedented.
Right. So when the warrant was unsealed, what did you find? I mean, was there anything interesting to note about the warrant itself?
The warrant was real sloppy work. It was written by a guy named David Aguilera, who's still with the ATF. But it was sloppily thought out and sloppily put together. And two-thirds of it is about child abuse or sexual statutory rape. So that was inflamed things. It was mainly devoted to allegations of child abuse, over which the ATF and the federal government have no authority, and how it was sloppy in other ways. I was saying that it accused Koresh and his people of having automatic weapons and hand grenades. And I think most of us believe that they did have 4 automatic weapons. So the ATF was right in that suspicion. But the warrant was just pretty well sloppily done. It identified Shotgun News as a clandestine publication. Shotgun News has hundreds, thousands of subscribers, and goes through the U.S. mail. That's not what I would call clandestine. So it was just kind of a, what's the word, sophomore job on that search warrant.
You mentioned how the ATF was expecting the Branch Davidians to be basically as easy as any surprise drug raid. And I guess, you know, the story really goes that, according to the ATF anyway, that, well, it would have worked out all right, except that the element of surprise had been lost. And so I guess what I want to learn from you is, how was the element of surprise lost, and what effect that had on the way the raid was carried out?
Well, there was a person who lived in Mount Carmel, a follower of David Koresh, who was a postman, a rural route postman, one of these contract postal employees. And he had been sent out that morning to find a copy of the newspaper, the Waco Tribune Herald. And as he was driving down the road, he ran into a person who was pulled over on the side of the road that he thought was in trouble. So he stopped to offer help. And the person he offered to help says, well, do you know where Mount Carmel is? I'm a TV reporter, and I have to be there to cover the raid this morning. David Jones told him where Mount Carmel is, and then he got in his car and drove up there to warn everybody at Mount Carmel that this was going to happen.
Did the ATF know that the Branch Davidians knew?
They did, because the ATF had an undercover agent who was inside of Mount Carmel when Jones made his announcement. And this undercover agent then got up and started making excuses for why he had to leave. And David and his people knew he was an undercover agent since this all along. And, well, we understand what you have to do. I'm with you. The undercover agent goes the street to the undercover house, where the ATF agents were living. Undercover agent went out and called his superiors and said, the Davidians know we're coming. The superiors then had to decide whether to go ahead with the big production or not. They decided to go ahead with it.
And they lied and said that he never warned them, right?
Afterwards, some of them did. That's right. 2 of them.
Okay, so how many agents are we talking about here when the ATF rolled up in front of Mount Carmel?
I don't think we know. Between 50 and 100. And it depends on how you want to make the count. Meaning, are you only counting the ones in combat gear, or are you counting all of them? If you want to count all of them, 100. Those in combat gear, between 50 and 70.
Marine, we've been Marine all this time. Just sit down with anybody. You said law enforcement out here before.
Yes, sir.
And I said, I'm straight across the table. I said, if you don't know about me, sit down with me, and I'll open up a group and show you something. I said, just like I told Robert. You know Robert, don't you?
Yes, sir.
You know, the guy that, your agent.
Yes, sir.
We've known about this, I think, because for 4 years.
Mount Carmelou, a rightness.
We knew you were coming and everything. You see, we were for you.
Do we know who shot first, or what exactly happened when they arrived?
I think we know. The people inside the building say the ATF shot first. The ATF say the people inside the building shot first. That's dealing with shots on the ground, which some people say were the first shots fired. But you've got a complication. There were three helicopters flying over Mount Carmel, and some of the people inside say the helicopter down on them, and that those first shots. People in the helicopters say they were fired upon, and some of them think that was the first shot.
Huh.
So we don't know who fired first.
Well, you mentioned how, as far as this being a public relations stunt, that the ATF was filming everything that happened at the front of the house. So can't we just watch the video and see what happened?
The helicopters don't appear on the ATF video. And worse than that, the ATF was filming this from across the street from the undercover house, and they have film of all of the raid to start. And they claimed for years that they couldn't find the first cassette of film. It has since been found, and it was blank. As if, I'm told what's on it, is that the camera fell over on the ground. So there is no film record of the start of that raid. The TV station guys who were there, their filming starts after the shooting had already broken out. Now, I should mention one other theory, because all of this is complex. The ATF admits that it shot at the dogs, and that it shot the Davidian's dogs before it shot at any people. And so if you're inside that building and you see soldiers out in your front yard and you hear shots, you don't know if those shots are at the dogs or at you. So we really just don't know who was the target and who fired first.
Well, and the jury ended up deciding that the firing from the house was in self-defense, right?
The jury decided that the Davidians weren't guilty of murder, and it points towards that sort of finding.
The biggest question, the one that, you know, if anyone ever tries to give the Davidian side of this story, the number one thing that you get back is, well, why didn't they just come out?
They didn't come out because it's sort of a reverse Noah's Ark. If you can imagine Noah's Ark, why didn't you jump out? Well, because God told you to get in that ark, and if you jump out, you'll drown. In Mount Carmel, they thought God had told them to stay in there, and that if they went out, their souls would be lost, and they might burn to death. Their interpretation of what was going on was that it was their religious duty to stay in there, so that's why they didn't come out. They thought their soul was worth more.
So I guess, you know, for the FBI negotiators who showed up at the scene, they really had their work cut out for them.
The FBI negotiators had a great, you say, far more to do than they could have prepared themselves to do on short notice. What they should have done is take advantage of some religious scholars who understood the language that Quraysh's people talked, who understood how they thought, who could quote the same scriptures at them. But the FBI decided not to do that. It decided that its Easter and Christmas religious folks were good enough.
Did the FBI agents, did they not believe that Quraysh believed? I mean, I get the impression from them that anything he said about God or whatever to them was just a diversion and a distraction and a delaying tactic, that they never really took any of that seriously at all.
I think probably some of the negotiators understood that those people inside were sincere. Some of the public spokesmen, like Bob Ricks, made it obvious. And I think Byron Tate said on TV this week that he thought David was a con man whose con was religion. So a great number of the FBI didn't believe David was religious at all. They thought he was another crook.
Which, if he was a true believer in the story he was saying, that sure does make it really hard to negotiate with him.
No, it makes it real hard. And, I mean, in general, what happened is that the whole world judged those people by secular standards, as if religion doesn't count for anything. And for the people inside, religion counted for everything. And, you know, when people say, why didn't they come out? They're presuming there was no biblical answer to that question, that all there was a common sense answer. It never was that way. Everything those people did, they could turn around and point to the Bible.
What was the relationship between the negotiators trying to settle the problem and the hostage rescue team tactical guys on the scene?
The hostage rescue people won't talk to me. And as far as I know, won't talk to anybody. The negotiators have talked, and they say it was sort of like the relationship between Hans Blick and George Bush. Right? Hans Blick is saying, let's don't go in, give me time. And George Bush is saying, let's roll the tanks.
So I'm thinking of movies I've seen where there's a hostage negotiator, and the negotiator's the boss. And the tactical guys do what he says, because he's the guy doing the negotiating, right? I mean, isn't that the way this is supposed to work?
No, that was never established that way. Both of these were co-equal parts, and there was one guy who was supposed to be in command of both.
And who was that? Jeff Jamar?
His name I don't recall right now. But in any case, he was supposed to be neither.
Probably all of us remember seeing on TV the FBI shining bright lights in the windows and playing Tibetan chants and audio of animals being tortured and skinned alive and that kind of thing. And I wonder if you can tell us, what was the origin of all the psychological warfare tactics there? What were they trying to accomplish, and whose idea was that? What was going on with that?
I don't think it's known. I don't think we have clear information on that, and I don't know how much you know about what I know, but I'll tell you exactly what the origin was. When Manuel Noriega, the dictator in Panama, took refuge in the Catholic Church in the cathedral in Panama, some reporters went and got big ears, mechanical ears, so that they could eavesdrop on the conversations between U.S. Army negotiators and church officials over Noriega. They wanted to eavesdrop on those conversations, and they pointed their ears from the hotel where they were staying towards the cathedral. Whereupon, the United States Army started playing hard rock real loud. And when asked why it was doing this, rather than saying, we're trying to interfere with the press, they said, psychological warfare. So a tactic was invented out of a lie.
Wonderful.
And the belief that this was psychological warfare spread. So they tried it at Mount Carmel, apparently wanting to deprive people of sleep. That's all that we can understand. The FBI says they were trying to make their stay uncomfortable. And as Clive Doyle pointed out today, this kept the children from sleeping as well as the adults.
To what degree were the White House and the Justice Department controlling events on the ground there as far as day-to-day operations and then major decision-type situations?
I'm not sure I know. There was a command center in Washington, D.C. at the Justice Department, and that, I think, is where the ultimate decisions were being made. the information was relayed from Waco to the Justice Department in D.C. I don't believe that Bill Clinton was watching day by day what was going on.
Is it true that at the time FBI Director William Sessions attempted to personally intervene in the negotiations?
He did, but he was told not to. Sessions had gone to school and lived at Waco. And he still knew people around there and thought he could do some good, but he was told not to come.
By who? By the president?
By either the president or Janet Reno. I don't recall which.
Was he planning on actually going there and meeting with Koresh face to face, or?
Well, he hasn't told us that. All we know is he was planning to come to Waco and take charge of things. Whether or not he was planning to go in himself, I don't know. He certainly could have done it.
I'm trying.
Meaning Koresh?
I know I can't ask you to, you know, assume someone's motivation, but I'm trying to figure out for what possible reason could the Justice Department or the President want to stop the director of the FBI from resolving this? I mean, he's the most capable of them all of getting this thing resolved peacefully, right?
I suppose what they would say is this is in the hands of the hostage rescue team who are specialists in their field.
Yeah, but
and
he's their boss.
Yeah, well, beats me. If there's anything that's disappointing about the Waco situation, it is that the government has to this day not come out and explained what was going on and what it did and didn't do.
So we got reports from the ATF and the FBI, but not from the higher levels, is what you're saying.
Well, and the reports don't say much. And 2 or 3 weeks ago, I called both agencies and tried to get them to talk about what happened in Waco, and they still won't talk. I mean, that's their policy. They say there are lawsuits pending, and so long as lawsuits are pending, they have nothing to say.
Well, I don't expect we can hope for that to change anytime soon.
No, but it represents to me a strange attitude on part of the government, because I would think the government's position ought to be, we always tell the truth, we believe in the court system, we believe that the truth will out in the court system, so we have nothing to hide.
Right,
and
I mean, if it was all Koresh's fault, then what would they have to hide?
Well, that's what I'm saying. It doesn't ring, that's not how I want my government to behave. I don't want my government to be afraid of its own courts.
Yeah, that might be an indication that you have a problem with your executive branch when they're scared to death of the judiciary.
I think it's an indication of how lawyer thinking has pushed aside civic responsibility. And, I mean, you get the same thing from prosecutors now. At one point, when prosecutors were prosecuting a man for murder or something, they would tell you everything they knew, because they believed that their job was to do an honest prosecution. Today, they won't tell you. They believe their job is winning cases, and sometimes they may do things that aren't fair.
I guess there's really no watershed where this change took place. It's just sort of the evolution of our system, huh?
I can't point to a time when that happened, no. It just seems to have occurred over time. As a reporter, I noticed the difference, but I can't tell you when I first started noticing it.
Back to the siege. After this thing had been dragging on for so long, the FBI said that, look, this guy said he was going to come out 5 or 6 times. He lied every time. We don't have any reason to believe that he's ever going to come out. He's going to stay there until hell freezes over if he can, so we're just going to go ahead and end this thing right now. Is that the case? Is there any reason to believe that Koresh was preparing to come out?
Oh, yeah. Koresh sent a letter out on April the 14th, 5 days before the end. And in the letter he says, I have received a new message from God. He tells me I no longer have to wait, that I have to write out an explanation of the 7 seals, and that after I do that, we should all surrender. And he was starting to work on the explanation of the 7 seals. a day or so later, the FBI talked to him, and they said, how's work coming on the seals? And he says, well, I've finished the first one. I'm into the second one. The FBI said, how long will it be before you finish them? Oh, if we can judge by the first one, probably be about 2 weeks. Well, the FBI wasn't going to wait 2 weeks. So they went in after him.
And they had even sent in typewriter ribbon and paper and stuff to help him get it
done,
right?
Right.
But then they come out and say that we had no indication that he was ever going to come out. So, all right, we're back on the air with Dick Revis from the San Antonio Express News. Go ahead, sir.
Well, I said David sent out a letter on the 14th saying that he would come as soon as he got the seven seals written. And the FBI knew that. And as you say, they sent him typewriter ribbons and so on. He was on his way out.
And so they ordered a raid.
They had by then already planned on a date for the raid, and they didn't change their date.
I see. So it was kind of, we're going in on the 19th no matter what. But they never told him that, right? They never told him, no, you don't have 2 weeks, you got 5 days.
What they told the people inside was that they would never go in.
So on the 19th, when the tear gas and all that, what was the FBI's plan? Who authorized it, and what happened to that plan?
Well, the FBI's plan was to spread that tear gas over 48 hours and to slowly make the people inside uncomfortable and make them come out. That was the plan that Janet Reno knew of, but in the fine print of it, which she did not read, it said that if the people inside fire upon us, we can step up the plan. We can move it faster. And what happened was that the people inside did fire upon the FBI's tanks, though they couldn't have done them any harm because all they had were light weapons. But they started firing on the tanks when the tanks started knocking holes in Mount Carmel. You'd fire on somebody if they started knocking holes in your house. And when that happened, the FBI then took the tear gas that was supposed to last 48 hours and threw it in about 4 hours.
So then they were out of tear gas. Then what'd they do?
Then they waited. And then the building caught on fire. They also sent out for more tear gas, but they didn't get enough. They got one shipment. It wasn't enough.
Besides the injectors on the tanks, they also had some sort of tear gas rounds that they were firing in the windows, too, right?
They had ferret rounds, right. And the sad thing is, each tank guy, the one with the who was firing the ferret rounds, had two boxes at his feet. One was a box of tear gas canisters, and the other was a box of incendiary canisters. And they both fit the same gun. They both looked pretty much alike. And they were reaching down there, shooting that gas real fast as they could get it out. And we don't know but what they might have picked up a canister from the wrong box and set the place on fire. They claim they never used their incendiary canisters, but in 1998, they were confronted with, had to admit that they had used at least one.
Do we know how many they actually did use, and when they were used? Were they used around the time when the fire broke out? And also, I believe I remember something from one of McNulty's videos where he says that the Texas Rangers found incendiary rounds at all three origins of the fire. Is that right?
They were found, but some of them, I think, are outside. And it's controversial whether any of them were found inside. So that answers the second question. What was the first one?
Oh, I don't remember. I was
reading. How many they fired?
Oh, right.
They fired about 400. But there's a strange thing that happened. Normally in a military maneuver, when a police maneuver, when you're issued 10 tear gas rounds, at the end of the action, you return those that you didn't use, and they're accounted for. I gave John Doe 10 rounds. He brought back 5. I gave him 10. He brought back none. There was no count back at Mount Carmel that we know of. So we don't know exactly how many were used or who used exactly how many, but we know that they had about 400 and they ran out.
Sir, do we know if they gave any consideration to the idea that in poking the holes in the building that they could perhaps destroy stairwells or block hallways and exits? I mean, was there a danger? Did they consider that they were trapping people in there?
They say they were opening holes for people to escape. Now, it's pretty obvious when you go knocking down stairwells, you ain't helping nobody escape. But they say they were trying to open holes so people could escape.
I see. There's the footage most of us, I think, have seen of a tank driving deep into the front of the building in order to get the gas into the concrete room.
Mm-hmm.
Do we know who was in there? And also, do we know what degree did the FBI know who was in there and who was around? I mean, surely they had surveillance cameras and things planted inside the house, correct?
We don't know who was driving the tank other than that it was an FBI agent. Inside the concrete vault, we know who was there because we found their bodies there, mainly women and children. The FBI did not have hidden cameras that I know of, but it had listening devices, yes. And it knew there were people in there. That's why it sent the tank to try to hit them with gas.
We knew that protection was in there. We believe we finally were able to make entry into that compound and were able to insert gas inside that protective area. We put massive gas in there. Their gas mask by that time had to be failing.
And it was almost exclusively just women and children in that room.
It was women and children. And they knew that, and they knew that there are no gas masks for children. They went in there to gas the children. What the FBI later said was we were counting on a maternal instinct that when those children get gassed, the mothers will bring the children out. As one lawyer, James Bannon, said, they were torturing babies and counting on a maternal instinct.
Boy, that sure is a pretty friendly policy for a national government to have in dealing with its own people. Gassing a child in order to try to provoke a reaction out of its mother.
Now, that was the explanation that Bob Ricks gave on national television, so there it is. And Byron Sage, Thursday night on ABC again.
A lot of flack has been brought up about the infrared footage from the plane flying overhead. The government says that that's the proof that the Davidians set the fire. The Davidians say that's the proof that the FBI shot at them and set the fire themselves. Is there anything conclusive in the FLIR? Can you learn anything for certain from watching that footage?
I myself have been unable to draw any conclusions from that footage. It's good information, but for me, it's not sufficient to be convincing one way or the other. The FBI's case from that footage is that three hot spots show up simultaneously. Three different parts of Mount Carmel seem to go on fire simultaneously, and the FBI says that means the fires were started. The problem I have with that is that all we really know is that the roof became hot in those three places at the same time. And the problem with that interpretation is that the roof was not of equal height in those three places. So I don't see how that shows that the fire started in those three places at the same time. On the other hand, the critics say that the tape shows people firing guns towards Mount Carmel from outside, shows FBI agents or Army personnel firing on the Davidians. At a time when the Davidians might have been wanting to escape because the building was burning. But the problem I have with that is that it posits that the FBI put itself in the line of fire, that it went out to a position from which it had insufficient cover and fired on the Davidians. And I don't think that I saw the FBI do anything that courageous the whole 51 days.
Well, but so, there's one clip of that footage that I'm thinking of where it seems as though two human figures get out of the back of a tank and lay down on the ground behind it, and flashes start coming from their position. So that's not that courageous, is it? I mean, hiding behind a tank?
Well, you got those two, but what about those over more by the cafeteria?
Touche.
So I don't know what to make of that. I would like to see the government explain it, but it hasn't explained anything. It just denies everything. It says it didn't fire any shots on April the 19th, and even that's stretching it. It fired 400 ferret rounds, which are certainly propelled by gunpowder. What it means is it didn't fire any bullets on April the 19th, and I don't know if that's true. I would like to hear them say, not only did the FBI not fire any bullets, but the Delta Force didn't, and nobody on our side of the conflict did. And I've never heard them make that thorough a denial.
I never have either, and in fact, that's what I was just about to ask you. Is it possible that it wasn't the FBI back there shooting at them, it was the Delta Force?
Well, we know there were Delta Force people at Mount Carmel. We don't know if they were that close to the building. We just don't know.
Do we know how many Delta operators were there?
No, I don't think we do. The last I know, we knew of about a half dozen.
I mean, originally they claimed there was only two or three advisors, right?
That's what they claimed.
So half a dozen sounds more like a fighting force-sized group of guys. I don't mean to leap to too much of a conclusion there, but there are people who have come forward and said, I've talked to the Delta Force guys, and they admitted that, yes, they were back there shooting. Isn't that correct?
Well, I've heard people say they've gotten admissions of all kinds, but I want to see the Delta Force guys say it before I believe it, right?
What do you make about the allegations of the shaped charge placed on the roof of the concrete room?
Don't know what to make of it. Now, I saw the hole, and it's a strange hole, but I don't know enough about explosives to tell you anything about it. I have no way of knowing.
So as a reporter, you haven't been able to find anyone who can tell you one way or another?
I found people who would tell me various things.
But
right? That heat caused it, that the boom might have caused it, and that it was explosions. We don't know. At least I don't feel that I do.
That's perfectly fair enough. This is one of the stories about Waco that I don't know how it slipped my mind at all. I'm reminded of it quite often. The story of the coroner's cooler truck that the Davidian bodies were stored in, and that someone had come and unplugged the cooler.
Well, what they told me at the Fort Worth Medical Examiner's Office is that the air conditioning system went down. Not that anybody unplugged it, that the air conditioning system failed on them, and therefore the bodies rotted away real quickly.
I see. So that was an accident then?
Well, that's what they say.
What about the missing front door? Is there any evidence about whatever happened to the missing front door?
I think the missing front doors, how do you say, it's probably hanging in somebody's den. There were two front doors in Mount Carmel. They were twins. They were metal. And we see in the films of April the 19th, the tanks knocking down both of them. So we know that both of them were there in front of the building where they fall when the tanks hit. They were in front of the building about 2 hours before the fire. Then when the crews come to clean up the remains of Mount Carmel, ATF and Texas Rangers for that point, they can't find one of the doors. And it so happens to be the door that the Davidians had always claimed the ATF had fired through. And because it was a metal door, you can tell which way the bullets were headed because it bends the metal. And all we know is that the ATF and FBI had a dumpster out there that day, and the dumpster got taken off before the Texas Rangers came. It may have been that the door was in that dumpster. We don't know, but that door's still missing.
And even Congress can't find it, correct? I mean, they're
nobody's been able to find it.
I mean, what I mean to make that point with that point is that if the government won't tell a reporter from the San Antonio Express News, okay, I understand. But if the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee is saying, look, I want the door, where's the door? And they still can't deliver it even for the Judiciary Committee, now we have a real problem, don't we?
Well, I think it's always possible in a deal like Mount Carmel that some of the agents were what we would today call rogue agents. Maybe the agents, one of them who fired through that door, got rid of it to save himself from censure.
Well, but I don't understand, though. The ATF wasn't there on the last day, were they?
Yeah, they were still around. Not all of them, but there were still ATF people working with the FBI, yes. And so it may be that it was, you know, somebody in the ATF trying to save somebody else's butt, right? Trying to save somebody else's behind. And may have done it on his own without any order and without telling anybody.
And in a case like that, it's really hard to say, you know, if it is a rogue agent. I mean, for all we know, the rogue agent is the special agent in charge.
No, we don't, yeah. We don't know that door. And the cap that Michael Schroeder wore are two of the great mysteries there. That
I thought that the cap had been recovered.
The cap has been found, but no one's ever run any powder burns tests on it.
I see. And for people
now, why not?
For people who don't know, Mike Schroeder is the guy who wasn't there at the time of the raid, but tried to come home a couple hours later and was gunned down and apparently executed. Few hundred yards from the house, correct?
Well, let's just say that he had two bullet holes in his head, and that's one too many. And he also had bullets cutting a couple of his arteries in his legs, in his torso, and two in the head. And he was wearing a stocking cap so that if somebody gave him a coup de grace, there would be powder burns on that stocking cap. The government has never said, we've examined this stocking cap and found no stains, or we've sent this stocking cap to an independent laboratory and it finds no stains. What it said originally was, we can't find the stocking cap. 3 or 4 years later, Mike McNulty found it, a researcher, but he doesn't have the power to run the test.
So there it sits. Unsolved murder, right?
An unsolved death. We don't know if it's murder yet. The ATF and Texas Rangers, who admit to firing at Schroeder, say they were firing back at him in self-defense. There were 17 of them with sniper rifles.
I'd like to find out, I already know, I'd like the people in the audience to understand what the jury found and then what the judge did with that.
If I can recall this, the jury went out. The Davidians were charged with conspiracy to murder, both the ATF agents and the people who died in the fire. The jury went out and says they didn't murder anybody, and says, but they did use a gun in the commission of a crime. And they bring their verdict back. The judge looked at it. He says it's an inconsistent verdict. It's obviously inconsistent. Because if you didn't commit a crime, how can you have used a gun in a crime? And his immediate comment was, we'll have to throw out the finding of guilty of using a firearm. So it looked as if all of these people were going to get off. But then the prosecution comes to him, shows him an obscure drug law statute that says if you use an automatic weapon in the commission of a crime, you're guilty of whatever crime they want to impute to you, essentially. The judge calls everybody back several days later, and he says, they used a gun in the commission of the crime, and the crime was murder. So you're guilty as charged. And he sentences the Davidians to about 4 years each.
How many of them are still in prison right now?
7 of them.
And these are all people who were acquitted by the jury. On murder charges.
Of everything except using a firearm. And the lawyers appealed all of this and finally won on only one ground. They were convicted of using an automatic weapon in the commission of a crime, and the Supreme Court held that the jury should have decided whether or not the weapons were automatic and not the judge. And the Supreme Court ordered the judge to reduce their sentences to 15 years, which he did, from 40 to 15. So they're sitting there doing the last of their, we're expecting out in 2006 and 2006 and 2007. Their time will be up. They will have served it.
That's incredible. And I, you know, any person in the audience can imagine, I guess, one, being a juror and having the judge throw out what you decided, but worse, being acquitted by the jury and then having the judge turn that upside down.
That was pretty impressive. That was pretty impressive. The jurors, two of them talked afterwards. Two jurors and one alternate. And what they said was that the impression of the jury was that these people probably, the Davidians, probably fired back thinking they were defending themselves, meaning self-defense. And so that's why they didn't find them guilty of murder. But they did find them guilty of using, of manslaughter and of using a gun in the commission of a crime. And so the jurors were, at least two of them were upset, and one of them for years was speaking everywhere she could about how she felt the judge had betrayed the jury's verdict.
That was Sarah Bain, correct?
Sarah Bain.
Yeah. Sure. Just a couple of more questions here real quickly. Article that you wrote in the Austin Chronicle, November 12, 1999, called Our Lion Eyes, about the new McNulty movie that had just come out, A New Revelation. You say in that article that you can't believe your eyes because your general knowledge and philosophical bent do not prepare you to embrace a conclusion of murder on the part of the federal officials at Waco. Is
mm-hmm.
that still the case, Mr. Revis?
I still don't know whether or not... I still don't believe that the federal government intended to kill anybody unless the gunfire thesis is true, the FLIR tape thesis. And I still don't know what to think of the FLIR tape thesis.
Okay. And
so I guess that's still essentially true.
Okay.
I'm not accusing the FBI of murder. I'm accusing them of negligence.
And for anybody else who wants to see that footage and make their own conclusion, it's included in Waco, The Rules of Engagement, and Waco, A New Revelation has
that's right.
a lot clearer
right.
Footage. And so people in the audience, you can probably go down to rent those and judge for yourself. I maintain,
Blockbuster and that other chain used to have a version of Rules of Engagement.
Yeah, and it played on HBO there for a little while. I can say for my own case, from what I've seen of the footage, it seems pretty clear to me, at least, maybe not necessarily in every case, but at least in one case, it is plain to see two men get out of a tank and fire machine guns at that house. And that's your host's point of view, and I can only, I guess, leave it at that. And the only thing I guess I have left to ask you, Mr. Revis, is are there any lessons that we should learn from this? Things that we can, I mean... People, you know, here it is 10 years later, it's kind of old news. People know everything they ever wanted to know about Waco already anyway. And the only reason I can really think to continue talking about this is that there's got to be something that we can learn from what happened here.
I mean, the FBI has learned a lesson and it no longer handles standoffs in the same way. But I think there's a bigger lesson that all of us can learn. And that is, I talked to Alan Stone, a Harvard psychiatrist who was involved in all of this, and law professor, and he pointed this out to me. He said, the one thing we have to learn is that when we start hearing that in any situation, all of the evil is on the other side, we better look out. We're demonizing. And I think that's the lesson that hasn't been learned from Waco. People still tend to see things in terms of good and evil, black and white, absolutely, without looking for our own culpability.
that you've been listening to an interview with Dick J. Revis, the author of The Ashes of Waco, an investigation, and a reporter for the San Antonio Express News. Thank you very much for joining us today, sir.
All right. Thank you for calling.